Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans with a Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, not too bad at all. We're just on the curve of needing to put up the Christmas lights.
Yeah, I think so. I've already seen a few people with their Christmas trees up early. I mean, it's only the... It's not even Thanksgiving yet if you're in the States, so, but we're already seeing the trees starting to go up in people's houses. I think people just want a bit of light and colour in their house at the moment.
I think they do. So, Rob, we've got Rob Walters here, who's in the US, and obviously, Rob, although you're not technically an American, you are in America, and therefore potentially celebrating Thanksgiving this week. So, what do you, you know, are people putting their lights up? Are you all ready for it, or do you put lights up for Thanksgiving as well?
Well, very, very timely, actually. My neighbor put lights up over the weekend.
Wow.
Christmas lights up, yep.
There we go. Okay, sorry. Now, we should go back and do a proper introduction, of course. So, Rob Walters from Pure Storage. Rob, we're going to talk about one of your products in a second, but why don't you just take a second to introduce yourself, and then we'll dive into the discussion.
Okay. So, yes, I'm Rob Walters, and I'm the general manager for Pure as a Service, which is our on-prem and cloud as a service.
Excellent. So, Pure as a Service, this is a technology or a service offering that has been around for a while, but you're on... What I think you've classed it as 2.0, but it's not really it's not like a generational release, is it? It's the next sort of enhancement of the features that you're offering. So briefly, just give people a little bit of a background as to what Pure as a service really means, and then we can dive into what 2.0 will actually mean in more detail.
Absolutely. So we look at as a service as having three primary components. There's the economic piece, the operational piece, and customer experience. And we really take the sort of public cloud model as our mantra, even though, you know, the bulk of what we do is delivered on-prem. So you think about cloud economics, you know, we have a commit and an on-demand model so that customers can optimize their spend as well as retaining agility. Cloud operations, we essentially own and manage all of the infrastructure required to deliver the service. And then cloud customer experience through Pure One, lots of forecasting, planning, and self-service capabilities. So all of that is required to deliver as a service in our definition.
Okay, brilliant. So let's just set some background, I think, because Martin and I have had a conversation about as a service offerings on and off. Gosh, it must be at least 12 months, if not 2 years, Martin. We've been talking about the idea of as a service models, haven't we? And I think we're always trying to work out whether we think they're what customers really want, whether OPEX is the right route or not. And I don't know, it's an interesting discussion, Martin, to decide, you know, where we sort of sit on that. So I'm interested to understand from Rob's perspective what the evidence is from what you've got as to the demand for this sort of service. So Rob, you know, what's the sort of the lead for that?
We talked about this quite a lot, haven't we, Chris? I mean, certainly even looking at how the traditional infrastructure vendors have tried to do it in the past, the various models which people try to come up with, this idea of on-demand or capacity on-demand type pricing. So yeah, it'd be really interesting what Rob's got to say about this.
I think that, I mean, when you say, you know, what's the sort of the evidence? I think there's sort of been a generational shift, and I would say we're probably in the second iteration of as a service. I think the first iteration is now probably more accurately called product on subscription, meaning, you know, it would be the same storage array and the same capacity that the customer would have bought if they were buying with CapEx, and then the same ongoing management responsibility for the customer. And if you looked at that, the benefits would be the move from CapEx to OpEx expenses, because nothing else really changes. So the second iteration of, you know, as a service delivery would be, you know, the sort of the true as a service over and above the products on subscription. And that would be when you layer in the operational benefits, which really enables the IT team to sort of de-risk their future capacity planning and obviously lower just the operational workload they have to do in managing and maintaining the infrastructure. You then also are able to give them and the storage administrator a greater amount of self-service. And I think this is one of the, you know, sort of big wins from the cloud, is that there are certain tasks that the customer doesn't want to have to call somebody to execute on. They just want to drive it through a self-service interface while still knowing there's somebody there that they can call for the bigger picture strategic items or for new project advice, things like that. So I think that's really the shift between the two that we've seen. And I would say within the last 12 to 18 months, we've seen a far more interest in adoption of the true as a service offering than the products on subscription type of customer.
Okay, and how much do you think that's been driven by the concept of cloud? Because, you know, effectively, I mean, that may seem like a leading question, but pretty much what you're suggesting is very much cloud-like in the sense that once you start buying services from somebody who's giving you a service-based model and you're not seeing how that infrastructure is delivered, you step back and start to think, well, I don't really need to worry too much about it. As long as I've got confidence in my vendor, whether it's a cloud provider or somebody doing something on-premises, as long as I've got confidence with them, that's good for me. So I wonder how much of this is being driven now because we've got that much more maturity in cloud in its own right.
I would agree. I would think that, you know, for most people, the cloud was the first time that they experienced remotely delivered IT services. You know, cloud is more prevalent than sort of managed hosting providers were prior to that. And so I think that, but the model is also that much more abstract over and above the hardware in the cloud model. And so given that that now has so much sort of years of tenure, if you like, I mean, you know, 2006 was sort of early, you know, early days of the cloud. That's a long time ago now. You know, it's very much an accepted model. But there, you know, there used to be trade-offs you had to make about, you know, where the service was delivered from. You know, you got the operational benefits, you got the OPEX benefits, but it had to be done in the cloud. So we had all the security concerns, you know, up front, which have, you know, gone away now largely. But then customers would start to ask, well, you know, is that a model I cannot have on-prem? And the initial answer was no. But, you know, now it's not the case. You can actually sort of mix and match your models and your locations in whatever best combination works for you as a customer.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that, Martin? I mean, we sort of talk about the OPEX side of things and whether that's really valuable, but I think Rob's made a good point that this is more about value add on top of that.
Yeah, I think I was actually going to ask Rob another question on this. Have you found that there is more interest now? Because companies are less willing to sink costs at the moment and they're finding an operational expenditure model much more attractive because they really don't know what the next 18 months look like anymore. We're in a very different world at the moment.
Yes. So, I mean, I would say, you know, this year has led to, you know, an increased interest in, you know, sort of preservation of capital, right? So that leads you to spending some OPEX. We have seen difficulties in, you know, staffing data centers, right? So the idea that there is less need to have people in the data center because services are being delivered, you know, as a service rather than as a box that you have to manage yourself is another, you know, 2020 specific area of interest. You know, sort of we have some evidence, you know, with our existing customers. We've seen a lot more on-demand usage in the past two quarters, which, you know, so far I take to mean they are valuing the agility that on-demand gives them over additional commitments, right? Yeah. Preserving capital, not being tied into things for the long term. You know, and our model has both. And so, you know, customers can pick and choose how they consume and they can obviously do both at the same time if they want to.
Okay, great. So let's go and dig down into the history of what the actual offerings were and have been from mm-hmm. Pure. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth just maybe almost going through a timeline and just talking about how things have sort of evolved. Why don't you take us through that, Rob?
Sure. So we've been doing this for a while, actually. I mean, this started as a directed availability kind of project in Australia, back end of 2016, early 2017. And it was popular. And it was actually brought to market as the Evergreen Storage Service in May 2018. And it was block only at that time. File and object storage services were included by 2019. And then when our Cloud Block Store service was launched, we created the unified subscription, which gives customers the ability to subscribe to one amount of capacity, and it be it on-prem or in the public cloud. So sort of de-risking their future cloud migrations. And then we renamed ES2, the Evergreen Storage Service, to Pure as a Service in August 2019. And so it's been Pure as a Service since then. And of course, you know, we're now talking about Pure as a Service 2.0, which, as you pointed out earlier, is not literally like a SaaS versioning, but it's just there, you know, major changes are here, kind of upgrade name.
Yeah, and I guess the reason you went down the name change from Evergreen Storage Service is because Pure as a Service doesn't have to just be about storage. It could be about some of your other packaged offerings, and therefore the name Storage as a Service doesn't entirely apply in those circumstances.
Exactly. I mean, it's a much better portfolio name, right? It gives us a whole lot more latitude to bring additional services to market as the company expands underneath it. So absolutely, that you know, and just drawing more, Evergreen Storage Service has the word service in it, but as a service is just a little bit more descriptive. So elevating it to the Pure level and having as a service seemed like, you know, the most logical and also kind of long-term solution for us.
So in terms of how it works then, I think it's interesting to get into the detail of exactly what the offering is and how you're offering it, because I joked to you about this when we had a chat ahead of time on this, Rob, that I'd seen an HP offering where the minimum term was like 4 years. And it seemed to me that a minimum term 4 years on a service didn't really feel as much like a service as just a longer lease of a piece of equipment. So for me, if you're telling me it's got to be like 4 years and I can't have anything at less than like 500 terabytes, well, we should end the conversation now and you can, end the call, end the discussion. But I have a feeling that's not the case. But I would like to understand the levels of granularity you offer, how easy it is to consume this and how easy it is to just switch stuff on and switch it off. And obviously, it'd be very important to tie that by service tier, because one of the things that interested me was that you have a range of service catalog offerings within the service itself. Mm-hmm. Lots of questions there to ask.
Yeah, you have to remind me of some of those as we go through. But yeah, I'll start off with the overall structure. I mean, you're exactly right, with that sort of flexibility and, cloud-like service nature. I mean, we really do use, public cloud models as our sort of North Star for this. I mean, I spent my last 4 years at Amazon and being a GM for some of the AWS services. So, I'm pretty familiar with what that means and very confident in what it means to deliver what customers want, as opposed to having to sort of push your previous offering sort of towards them in different financially structured way. So with that in mind, very flexible. Minimum commitment starting as low as 50 TIB, from a time perspective, as low as 12 months.
Okay.
And so what we see is that effectively that removes the sort of linkage from the physical to what the customer actually needs. They'll describe how much they want and they'll have an understanding of whether their storage needs just sort of increase over time or there's any type of seasonality there. And we'll use that to help them understand what they should commit to versus what they should use on demand. Because obviously, it's our goal to optimize a customer's spend. And by that, I mean, make it as low as possible, not as high as possible, right? We're in this for the long term and making sure that they get the best usage and utilization out of the service is critical.
Yeah. I just want to raise something there with Martin, and that's an interesting one from an end user perspective, Martin. And that's one of the things that we are typically terrible about in the enterprise is, not every enterprise, you might be perfectly good at this, is forecasting and getting other business units to help forecast what our demand is. And it strikes me that just like if you were buying a mobile phone contract or you were doing other things that were service-based, you need to sit down for a second or two and think, what is it I really need from this and how much am I going to consume of it and therefore what's my usage profile? And if end users like yourself and other companies, Martin, don't sit down and do that, that could be a problem because, you're going to have to dig that information out.
Well, yeah, man, it's interesting. So you've got the minimum commit. So working out what your minimum commit levels are and then where you need your flexes is understanding where your baseline is. And I think there's quite a lot of companies who don't have an idea about that. I will say one thing with storage is you seem to never really need less. It's always going up. It's the one thing which we talk about elasticity with storage. I can't remember the last time I went back and looked at things and thought, oh, we're using less than we were using a year ago. That doesn't seem to happen very often. But I also suspect people often overestimate. You just have to look at, you mentioned mobile phones. Well, how many people actually are way within their mobile phone plan? How many people actually use all their minutes in the data? There aren't very many people who get anywhere near it, but it makes you feel comfortable, doesn't it? It gives you that idea, but I'm never going to have to pay any more. I'm never going to go over the top. It's a comfort, and it's a known thing. It's a known quantity. So, every month I'm going to spend, if you're on storage, I'm going to spend $50,000 or whatever it is. And if you could have saved money, well, you know what? I think a lot of times actually finance teams might not necessarily look that close at that, but if you've gone over it, they may have a lot more to say to, well, why have you spent more? Well, actually the business is doing more. But this is where the vendor can come in and they can actually help you review every year, certainly if you're on or not, as a service offering. So you know what, you've never got anywhere near that. We should be looking at how we change it for the next 12 months or however it is. And I assume we can do things like that with this offering, Rob.
So sorry to interrupt. I didn't want to interrupt you there, but I just want to slightly lead that question, because I did mention at the very beginning of this huge monologue of questions that I threw at you, the idea of service catalog and service tiers. So that this might be a good opportunity to sort of mention it at this point.
Sure. So maybe there's one point I wanted to make for Martin first, which is we actually would prefer to get not have the customer in the situation where we need to sort of back down the commit in the first place. So this is about getting the right size footprint in the beginning, and then through a combination of our, you know, AI in Pure One and our customer success team who are managing and monitoring capacity on a daily basis. We also have an SLA for getting additional capacity on site in less than 5 days. And we also maintain a 30% buffer on the capacity the customer's actually committed to. So all of that is how we create the elasticity. And so if unexpected demand occurs, we've got the ability to react to it very, very quickly. As you say, most times it doesn't ever come down. But, you know, if it does, you know, obviously we can talk about, you know, reduced commitments as you know, part of the next contract discussion. But our coterminus, we can certainly do additional capacity coterminus with the discussion. So we don't have to kick off a new, you know, 3 year or whatever the contract is.
So before a customer gets involved, commits to this, how much work do you do with a customer up front, looking at their existing environment to actually understand what they really use? Because My storage environment is quite unusual, but actually we do use an awful lot of it because we're a media company and we tend to fill things up to threshold and we start spooling things off to tape or other nearline storage. But I do know, and if you look at a lot of compute storage and a lot of enterprises, their average utilization is probably 60% if they're doing a good job. I would hope you do quite a lot of work with a customer before they enter something like this. So you know what? You've got too much storage on the floor at the moment anyway. We're going to help you reduce that and give you that. We're going to give you some money back.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's very much the value prop of sort of moving to as a service, especially when it's sort of highly managed from a capacity perspective. So getting the initial footprint right is kind of a critical factor because, as you say, you don't want to be looking back and say, oh, we had three times too much storage on day one. We've been overpaying. And so we're very careful to make sure we understand the customer workloads, the capacities, you know, the growth patterns, et cetera. And, you know, our SE team does a great job doing that. And then our customer success team actually helps manage, you know, through the migrations and make sure that what was expected is actually what pans out. And if it isn't, we'll be there to proactively do something about it with the customer. So, you know, we have a very sort of SaaS-like customer success ethos, which is, you know, the customer has to be successful with our service or we fail as well. It's not about the deal and walking away afterwards. And so making sure that they're happy, they actually are using and adopting and getting good value out of the service is critical to our success.
That just sort of raises an interesting point for me there, Rob. And I think this might be slightly jumping ahead of our order of agenda, not that that really makes any difference. But that's the whole benefit of things like Pure One. So if we go back to before Pure One came out, before anybody had these sort of analytics systems, most of the feedback that you got from the dial home type technology was all about, I've had a failure in a component. Drive failed, backend controllers failed, or something's gone wrong. The system dials home, engineer turns up and just doing basic part replacement. When we started getting solutions like Pure One and all the other vendors have got, you know, competing models, it wasn't just detail on hardware failures that you were starting to get back. You were getting back a huge additional set of data that was not only telling you about the infrastructure, it was telling you about growth, it was telling you about utilization, it was telling you about connectivity, so you can see what's connected to the equipment, so you can start seeing which applications are in use and so on. So I think some of what you can deliver now as part of your as a service comes from, or a huge amount of it comes from, the ability to get the metrics from a service like Pure One to be able to be proactive and feed that back to the customer to help them out in their own management of that equipment.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the connectivity back to Pure One is actually an essential and, you know, sort of mandatory part of the service, as it were, because, you know, without it, we're blind. And offering all of the service layers and the proactive support around it, you can't do it without it. It's very, very necessary. But as you say, you know, you've got the workload planning aspect, you've got, you know, extrapolating current growth patterns. And then obviously we've got, you know, that's available for the customer to do, but we've also got the customer success team looking at this on a daily basis as well. And so, you know, the goal is here that we understand what's going on with the customer within, you know, the current time period. We know when additional workloads are coming on. You know, we've planned everything in advance if it's necessary, or we know that we can handle it with what's already on site. So we know we develop a very sort of intimate relationship with the customer as part of the service.
We talked about service catalogs a few seconds ago, but we didn't really get into the detail of that. And I think this is quite an interesting one, because if you look at the way that you currently deliver your technology, you've got a separate portfolio for high-end file. You've got Block, which would be Flash Array, which comes in two models, X and C. And within that, you do have a file offering, which is not necessarily the same as the high-end file. So what happens when the customer wants to mix and match from those different offerings? You know, how would you go about sort of putting in a configuration that could support multiple service levels, if you like, and different types of requirements?
I guess there's probably sort of two levels of answer to this. From the customer perspective, they should not really have a concern about the specific infrastructure that gets deployed, box A, box B, you know, box C, et cetera. So, you know, they'll look at the service catalog, they'll say, you know, within the block service, I'd like, you know, X hundred tib of performance and X hundred of premium. And that's what shows up, right? It's most likely to be, two pieces of in separate infrastructure. Because as you say, you know, at some point the infrastructure maps down to, you know, underlying pure devices, but the management of it, we all completely as a service. You know, the customer never actually has to go and worry about which one's delivering my premium, which one's delivering my performance, and do anything on the box, because all of that's handled by us. And so it'll pop up in Pure One as, you know, there are two subscriptions with each individual tier available. Now, you know, once you get down to sort of much more specifics than that, you know, we have a, you know, bill of materials, if you like, you know, that maps to exactly our performance tiers. You know, we'll change that over time as, you know, our infrastructure evolves. But, you know, that's for us to worry about and for the customer to, you know, forget they ever had to, and, you know, just worry about, you know, what their business and IT outcomes are, as opposed to infrastructure management.
Okay, great. Now that sort of led me on to one question, which I think it might seem like a quite a basic area to discuss, and a basic set of questions, but I'm sure there's a lot of people who are at home thinking, well, what is this going to look like compared to what I do normally? So, for instance, if I go and lease or buy the hardware solution from a vendor, I will put it in, I'll rack it. You might be still expecting me to do that in a service model. But once I actually get it in play, somebody's got to do the monitoring. Now, we've just talked about how you're managing that, so that, you know, that's handled separately. And fault component replacements, those sort of things, you're still doing that. You know, I guess there's a relationship there that says, we ship it to you and you put it in on our behalf, or we have somebody come in and do it, you give us access to the data center, that's all fine. But what happens when you start putting in multiple pieces of kit and you now need to provision that up to end users and hosts? How do you sort of convey that level of information to the system administrators? Is it really just simple as saying, this is this box supporting this tariff or this tier, please connect to this, you know, or if not, connect to this one? You know, is it that sort of simplistic?
Pretty much, yes. So as you say, I mean, all of those sort of, you know, mechanical, physical pieces we actually do as part of the service. So, you know, the installation, you know, ongoing management, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, once the infrastructure is there, you know, giving the administrators who actually do the storage allocation, you know, the right pass naming, right? So they can actually get to, you know, so they understand where the premium is versus the ultra tier, et cetera, et cetera. That's essentially all you would do. I mean, really, that's very, very similar at that point to as if it was a physical box and they had managed it themselves, because the interface is the same, you know, just what's the path so I can actually get to the storage I want to allocate to my user.
Okay. And the reason I guess I was asking that question is, you know, as we go further on and things become a more nuanced service and you start maybe offering something where the service levels are different, or maybe you offer more tiers, or you do something where you're flexing the service a little bit, you certainly don't want people touching the stuff that you haven't given them access to. You know, if you put some equipment in and they decide to use it and it's now running their production environment, you know, unpicking that is a little more tricky than it would be if it was, you know, a service running in Amazon directly, where you can't see what's going on. So it's a slightly different model, isn't it?
It is, although we haven't come across a problem yet with somebody sort of, let's say, using it when they shouldn't be. The environments are generally pretty locked down, and the use case tends to be unexpected demand that wants to go into on demand, right? And that's something, you know, when we call it on demand, it's not overage, right? So the pricing is very fair, very everyday good pricing. So, you know, we want people to be able to use it if they need to. But, you know, there is that sort of slightly different paradigm, as you say. But essentially, you know, what we're exposing is, you know, the volumes and the file shares, et cetera, that, you know, the storage admins then control out. You know, it shouldn't be available to anybody elsewhere in the organization, as it wouldn't be if it was a CapEx owned and managed array.
Yeah, fair enough. What about pricing then? You know, are you publishing pricing? I've seen some information you shared to us, but I wasn't sure. You don't have to give me the numbers now, by the way. I just want to understand, you know, your attitude towards publishing the numbers, because like I mentioned earlier about other vendors, you see a lot about, oh, here's what it is up front, and then you look at it and you think, wow, okay, I'm not really understanding why you're not going to tell me exactly what it is you're offering. So are you being honest about the numbers and publishing those?
Absolutely.
I don't mean you're being dishonest and giving us false numbers. I mean, you know, is it overt and upfront on the website?
Absolutely. No, it will be as part of this launch. I mean, you know, going back to that kind of cloud level of transparency, right? You know, it's in our interest to educate and have customers understand which service, which tier, and what it's going to cost, and what the benefits of commitment are in capacity and term concept, you know, relatively, right? And so we want them to know, and it makes sense for them to know. And so we will be publishing pricing on the website. It's MSRP pricing, you know, as a partner-led organization, you know, all of our deals go through partners. But we want, you know, the structure of the model and essentially, you know, budgetary quote level of you know, specificity to be available to customers so they understand what they, you know, what they would be using and what the ongoing cost would be.
Mm. We've talked about this, Martin, haven't we, about, you know, transparency, pricing transparency, or lack of it in some vendors.
Yeah, I think so. But I think if you're moving into this cloud model, you're going to have to, because you can obviously, you know, you can go onto a cloud provider's website and you can start playing with their, there's a rate card, there's some calculators. So calculators sometimes aren't the easiest things in the world to use, but you can certainly give you probably a worst case figure. And I think that's what we need to do. And I would encourage all vendors to start being a lot more transparent about their pricing, both for services and offering, and also for somebody just coming off the street who wants to buy something which they want to put in their data center. Chris, how many times have you tried to look through a vendor's website to try and work out exactly what the list price of something is?
Yeah, it's always been a challenge. And I know we've talked about this on a different discussion, but it's always been a challenge, I think, partly because with a lot of the original pricing models, every single component down to the bezel on the front of the array was priced up or at least had a line item. So when you went through the old bill of materials that came with some of the vendors, you'd be going through pages and pages and pages of things that just had weird acronyms or names, and you'd be questioning, why on earth have I got, why do I even care what this is? Because you can't deliver it to me without some of these components in. So don't even bother listing them. So I think one of the things with the service side of things is getting back to that simplicity of all-inclusive, I think, becomes really important.
Yeah,
you know, and obviously that's down to you as a vendor to make sure you're including everything. That's your responsibility now, but I don't want to even have to go down to that level.
Just start per gigabyte cost, okay?
Yeah.
This is how much it's going to cost me. I assume it's going to be like that. I mean, obviously when you get into something like AWS, where your background is, obviously the calculations get rather more complicated because you'd be trying to work out how many IOs and things like that. But I assume this is a really very simple model to play with.
It is. I mean, there's basically, you know, one starting price per tier of each service. And it is, as you say, it's per gig per month. And so if the customer, you know, picks a tier of service that sounds like the one they're interested in, they'll understand what that looks like, and they can actually request, you know, through the calculator, you know, get a quote and have an understanding of what that will actually be for them. And then they can model out different scenarios, you know, well, what if I do a 3-year, what if I do a 1-year, you know, where's my balance point, where am I happy, right? So then they can make the right decision for them.
So, Rob, I really wanted to go and touch on one other area related to this, and that's this whole idea of SLA guarantees and what happens if you don't meet the guarantees that the customer might want. And the sort of things that obviously are relevant here are uptime, performance, latency, you know, the traditional metrics that become service metrics as part of an offering like this. So what's the position for that?
So we have SLAs around availability. We have 6.9s on availability and the capacity upgrade timeline that I mentioned before, you know, the 5 days or less getting the additional capacity on site. Everything else is really more of a KPI. And now that's because, you know, this is, you know, the world of storage, right? So many answers are, you know, start with it depends, right? So, you know, the way to describe the performance of the service is in very clearly defined terms with certain workloads, you know, block sizes, IO rates, et cetera, et cetera. What that means is, you know, your mileage may vary between the standard, you know, using IO meter with these settings and your own workload. Now, that is something we work very hard with customers to make sure we land them on the right tier up front. You know, the SE organization does a great job there. We have POC capabilities, you know, it's going to be the right one. But, you know, we've always had within Pure a very strong customer ethos. You know, we've got a right size guarantee, you know, on our arrays. So if it turns out that, you know, it's not right for the customer, we will make it right. But one thing I can guarantee is that the performance KPIs tied to the service tiers will absolutely be adhered to, because, you know, we don't actually, you know, we don't sort of pick our hero numbers for those. That's the all day long 24/7 number, right? Mm-hmm. You know, And so that's sort of the minimum you'll get. And so realistically, you know, you pick whatever your performance is, you find, you know, the gap between the two services that you want, and you put it in the one underneath the guideline, and that's where you sit. Now, of course, if the customer workload ends up being bizarrely different, we'll fix it. We'll make it right.
Okay. And you mentioned also a 5-day turnaround on getting additional capacity.
Yes.
Then obviously the additional capacity can mean different things. So first of all, you know, you might have to replace or upgrade an array if it's not big enough, or you might have to put a different model in. I guess it's sort of 5 days for the basic thing of putting additional drives in rather than shipping and racking new equipment, because customer might have their own like SLAs within that. Or is it literally, we'll give it to you and then it's up to you to put it into your data center?
It's a little bit between the two. I mean, we do a lot of expedited shipping. So whole array, just some disks or a shelf, not really a difference, doesn't matter to us. We'll get it there in that time frame. Then, as you say, you get a little bit of sort of, you know, customer leeway and problems, because, you know, we may be able to get somebody there in a certain time frame, but then maybe they can't get somebody there to, you know, organize, you know, just to walk through and getting to the equipment and things. And so we'll, you know, we'll SLA the piece where the equipment and a person could possibly be there, but then we'll work with their timeline after that. So, you know, the customer logistics always ends up being a factor we have to, you know, play into, but, and so we can't SLA that piece of it. But yes, it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, small piece or large piece of infrastructure needs to be delivered, we'll get it there in that time frame.
Yeah, that was always a problem, Martin. I don't know about you, getting stuff into data centers in a scheduled fashion.
I think that's the biggest reason people try to move into public cloud, Chris.
Yeah,
because it's so hard at times to get things into data centers. Data centers are full, or just change control. That's the concept. That's the beauty of an on-demand system. You just say, actually, I need another 200 terabytes or whatever, and it's there. You don't have to go and arrange for a new array to be delivered, to be cabled in, racked and stacked. You don't have to do your power calculations or that kind of things. Actually, what Rob's saying is in some ways is really nice, but actually, as he alluded to, there is a whole load of additional complexity about getting a new piece of kit into a data center. Is not always the vendor's problem. It's they can get the kit there, and then the customer will sit there for 6 months. They work out, well, I need to shuffle that. Where have I got enough rack space? Where have I got enough connectivity? Yeah, so that's where I think it will get a bit more challenging and a bit more interesting.
Yeah, I have an opinion on that, I think. And that's where it comes down to the vendor's understanding of the customer and their relationship. So if as a vendor, you know, you can, for example, just turn on stuff remotely and you can have it all pre-planned and the capacity is there and you know the gross is a certain level, you can just switch on what's that 30%. If it's outside of that, you need to have an understanding of what that customer is like to deal with. And if you know that customer is pretty good at getting kit into the data center, perhaps you might can, you know, you can leave it to the last minute to ship. Or if not, you have to ship a bit ahead of time. And then it becomes a contractual discussion as to whether you can get away with charging the customer for that little bit of extra time they've got that equipment they're not using, or whether that's something that becomes a negotiation. But ultimately, then I'd hope that that goes back to the customer, to them to be a bit more efficient about how they actually manage their own equipment.
So much as I agree with, you know, the point about, you know, it's complicated and everything kind of relies on the customer helping with the deployment, we wouldn't actually charge until the capacity was installed and available to the customer. Everything we do from a billing perspective is based on, you know, written actual used versus provision. I mean, obviously the commit is different, right? But even the amount that we measure on the commit, you know, everything is based off of, you know, the amount the customer writes to it. So, you know, their on-demand amount, you know, if you're using the 30%, you don't get a bill for the 30%, you get a bill for exactly the, you know, the amount that you used. So in this case, when the new capacity comes online, would be the service start date that the billing would actually pick up from.
Okay. So Rob, that's all great. I think that gives us some real good background there to understanding the platform and the product and the offering. The question I guess we need to ask now is availability. When does it come out, or is it already available?
So yes, the GA date is the 9th of December. So depending on when people are listening to this, it's either coming soon or already out. But the 9th of December is the date to bear in mind.
Great. And where can people go to learn more? Where should we point them to? Websites, URLs?
Best place to go is purestorage.com.
Perfect. Okay. Well, Rob, it's been really useful to dig down and understand specifically your implementation of storage as a service. Will this be expanded to a wider set of portfolio products, do you think, over time? Hence the reason for the name, as we discussed at the top of this. should we expect to see more, I guess, is the question.
There's definitely more in the pipeline. Stay tuned.
Perfect. Okay, Rob, thanks very much for your time. Great to talk to you and look forward to catching up soon.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.